Good morning, Your Honors. Jessica Zeldin on behalf of the plaintiffs below. I rise for the sole reason of introducing my co-counsel, Mr. Robert Rothman from the Coghlan Stoya firm. Mr. Rothman will be making the bulk of the argument on behalf of the plaintiffs below and appellees. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Good morning, Your Honors. Martin Lesner on behalf of the Mat 5 defendants. With me, I have my co-counsel, Charles David Al and Christy Tillman from the law firm of Paul Weiss, Rifkin, Garrison, and Wharton. And I have Carrie Ann Fay from Young Conaway. And I reserve 3 minutes at the end of Mr. Rothman's argument.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Henry Hyman for the appellants, defendants below. I'd like to introduce to the Court Sarah Weber, who is going to make the argument today. She's from the law firm of Hewlett, Harper, and Stewart in San Diego. I realize that someone else was initially going to do that, but unfortunately that can't be. I'd also like to introduce to the Court, sitting at the table, my partner Susan Kaufman. She was with me at Cooch & Taylor. And at this point, I would ask Sarah Weber to take her argument.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Sarah Weber with Hewlett Harper Stewart. I represent the appellants, who are the Michael Joel Stone Revocable Trust, Albico, Inc., and Roger Whitson and Daniel Smith. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal. As I'm sure you're aware, the appellants have raised 5 issues in their appeal. The first issue is whether or not the requirement that the class members who tendered their shares early return the proceeds of that tender in order to opt out of the settlement violated their constitutional due process rights. The second argument is whether or not the settlement notice was inadequate because it failed to comply with the notice requirements of the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act, or PSLRA, and then 3 related issues, whether the release contained in the settlement was overbroad in its inclusion of claims pending in the Southern District of New York, whether the parties below met their burden to demonstrate the fairness of the settlement as it related to those federal claims, and whether or not the Michael Joel Stone Revocable Trust and Albico, Inc., who I'll refer to as the Stone Appellants, were properly excluded from the class and the Court of Chancery's denial of their motion to intervene. But I'd like to focus on 3 issues, the limitation placed on the right to opt out, the reasonableness of the settlement and fairness of the settlement as it relates to the federal claims and the release of those claims, and the notice requirements under the PSLRA. The procedural history of the case has been outlined fairly extensively in the briefing, so I don't want to recite it, but I'd just like to highlight a few important facts. On May 1st, the plaintiffs below filed a case in the Southern District of New York asserting federal securities law violation claims that were centered on false and misleading statements made by the defendants in the prospectus and other selling documents for the fund that's at issue. Those claims, if they're proven, entitle the class members to rescission or recovery of their entire investment. Then, approximately a month later, Citigroup initiated a tender offer that's the subject of the case below before the Court of Chancery that offered investors the opportunity to liquidate their investment in exchange for a broad release of any and all claims against Citigroup and its affiliated entities. The tender offer contained an early settlement provision that allowed investors to tender and receive payment before the tender offer actually closed, and a third, or I think approximately 36% of the fund's investors took advantage of that early tender procedure and were paid out thereunder. Then,
do you agree with the Court of Chancery's assessment that Whitson never had a reasonable expectation that he would be able to both keep the proceeds and pursue the claims he was required to release?
Your Honor, no. We don't agree with that assessment that Vice Chancellor found that the parties weren't entitled to, or the early tenderers weren't entitled to opt out without paying back the early proceeds because they had no reasonable expectation, because that assumes that the early tenderers weren't opting out, but rather revoking their tender offer.
So what it was the reasonable expectation that you're arguing for then?
Well, I think the reasonable expectation is simply that they would be bound to the terms of that original tender offer, and them taking the early tender and then being subject to the original release that they signed off on when they, you know, participated in the early tender.
Well, I gathered that what you're arguing up to now relates to the opt-out issue.
That's right. I think.
If I understand your position correctly, the premise of the argument is that the class members have a right to opt out unfettered by any burden.
That's right.
And your contention is that that basically enforcement of the promise or the condition that was in the original tender offer arrangement is an unconstitutional burden. Is that correct?
That's right, Your Honor. That the
even though it was contracted for.
Well, I think it's a little bit different in that the original tender offer did provide that investors who tendered.
I'm sorry, it is an unconstitutional burden. That's your position?
Yes, that the imposition of that limitation.
All right, even though it was contracted for?
Well, I think that's where the discrepancy lies.
You disagreed that it was contracted for?
Well, exactly, yes. Our position is that they contracted for the opportunity to revoke their tender under that original tender offer, but they did not contract to preclude themselves from, well, they didn't have any expectation at all about a potential class action settlement that could impact.
But either way, if the tender were revoked or undone, they would be giving back the money.
If they were to revoke the tender, they certainly had a reasonable expectation that they would.
And the option that gave these shareholders the right to opt out would in effect be a revocation of the tender, would it not?
Well, I think that's where our argument is a little bit different. We're saying no, it would not be a revocation. It's merely the opportunity to be in the same legal position that they would have been had the class action settlement never occurred, and that would be they would have taken the early tender and signed the release in that original tender offer, but not be subject to subsequent events in the Court of Chancery and the settlement agreement approved by Vice Chancellor Lamb.
Is it correct that there's no authority that straightforwardly holds that this type of condition, that is the payback of the tender offer proceeds, is a due process, is a burden that violates due process?
You're right, Your Honor. I don't think there really is a case that has directly examined this type of litigation or this type of limitation that was placed on the opt-out rights. As we said in our briefing, there's been very little written on this subject. But I do think the case that we briefed and that the plaintiff appellees examined as well from the Sixth Circuit, it's called In Re Inter Op Procedure. Thesis litigation.
That involves completely different facts, though, does it not?
It involves different facts, but I think the concerns that the opinion that the Sixth Circuit issued really get to the heart of what the concerns are here. There it was a class action settlement that was structured in such a way that anyone who opted out would basically be placed behind the class action in terms of eventually recovering. So it really placed a large financial disincentive on opting out. And here we contend that it's the same type of burden that the early tenders face. In both cases, it's a disincentive on opting out. And
are there any equitable conditions that could be imposed on for opting out by the court?
I mean, that's obviously a hypothetical question, but I can't envision a situation where that right could be burdened in that way. I mean, it seems like it's a fundamental right to be able to exclude yourself and not be bound from litigation that affects you, but that you're not directly participating in. And that's, I think, what Schutz and its progeny really stand for.
Well, could there be a time limit for opting out?
Well, certainly there is, yes.
So
yeah.
There's some conditions that
that's,
can be played.
That's true, Your Honor.
Well, where do you draw the line, and how would you describe a permissible one and an impermissible one?
Well, I think that a time limit has clearly been established as a permissible limitation that's placed on the opt-out. Yes, it's in the Court of Chancery's rules, and you know, most other states, and certainly the federal rule provides for that. But when, for instance, if a shareholder does not receive the notice to opt out, then they might have arguments later on that they should not be bound. So as long as the notice is provided and they have been given the opportunity, that certainly, you know, falls within the realm of what's acceptable. And the time limit, I would say, is sort of different in that respect, in that it gives the plaintiff or the absent plaintiff that opportunity. And here, there's a greater burden that's being imposed in the sense of returning money and unwinding the transaction and everything that would go along with being able to exercise the right.
Well, the Sixth Circuit case, as I read it, suggests that there may be a point where the burden or the price that has to be paid to opt out can be so great that it has constitutional dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't really supply any analysis or way to reason through or to create bright lines dividing, you know, burdens that would be due process violations and those that wouldn't. So where are we? How do we address that?
Well, I would say that it is difficult to sort of envision where the line gets drawn and what a bright rule test would be, but clearly a great burden was placed on this right, and I think that's really evident when you take into consideration the fact that of the 36% of the investors who did tender early, zero of those class members effectively opted out of the settlement. I understand that two sent in opt-out forms but didn't tender back, so presumably they did not make an effective opt-out, whereas I believe over 30% of the rest of the class, the 65 or so class members who did not participate in the early tender, opted out. So while that certainly doesn't directly answer your question about where a bright line rule falls, I think it's strong evidence that here the opt-out right was burdened in such a way that really impacted and violated these class members' due process right to opt out. I think those questions really get at the heart of the issues I wanted to address with respect to the opt-out issue in the matter. One other thing I would raise is that it's, in his opinion, Vice Chancellor Lamb, I think, seemed to recognize the issue here and the importance of providing an unfettered opt-out right, although he didn't accept our arguments when he said that the opportunity to opt out is required without requiring the relinquishment of anything of value. And certainly these class members were required to relinquish a great deal of money, which is valuable, to exercise their right to be excluded. I also think that this right is particularly important and really can't be overstated in the context of this settlement agreement, where the Court of Chancery really placed special importance on the availability of the right to opt out in his determination that the settlement was fair and reasonable. The next issue I wanted to address was the release of the federal claims and the fairness and reasonable of the settlement as it relates to those claims. We don't contest that under Matsushita, the Court of Chancery had the legal authority to approve a settlement that included the release of the federal claims that were pending in the Southern District. However, the Court of Chancery has also stated that it should consider the release of such federal claims with particular skepticism. And in this instance, the Court of Chancery really did not apply that heightened skepticism to his determination for a number of factors. The manner that the settlement was rushed through and the economic climate at the time, I think, factored into Vice Chancellor Lamb's thinking, even though there really was nothing on the record to.
Well, the argument made by the other side is that that in doing their due diligence to determine to make their own assessment of the fairness of a settlement which would involve a dismissal or release of the federal claims,
mm-hmm.
That counsel assessed or made their own independent assessment of the value of those claims and concluded that the relinquishment of those claims, that there was fair compensation in the settlement for the relinquishment of those claims. That's a factual or a mixed legal and factual determination. What basis do we have to conclude that that's erroneous as a matter of law?
Well, you're right, Your Honor. It is a mixed question, I think, of law and fact. One important factor was the plaintiffs really abandoning those claims and leaving them to my clients to prosecute in the Southern District of New York, and then really bringing them only in sort of at the last minute to settle the case. And given that fact, I think that it's understandable that there wasn't a large factual basis that they provided to the Court of Chancery to really make his determination. And they really didn't meet their burden to do that. And, you know, that's how we believe Vice Chancellor Lamb came to the position that he ultimately reached.
You're into your rebuttal time,
yes.
Which you're welcome to use or
well,
not.
I think I'll go ahead and conclude my argument. Thank you, Your Honors.
May it please the Court, Robert Rothman from Coghlan, Stoya, Geller, Rudman, and Robbins on behalf of the plaintiff and class appellees. In a careful and well-reasoned opinion and order, the Chancery Court properly approved the settlement of this class action case that involved investments in a hedge fund known as MAT5, which was operated by Citigroup. MAT5 was designed to engage in a municipal bond arbitrage strategy and generate returns. That strategy failed, which caused Citigroup to invest $246 million into the fund and ultimately launch a tender offer for the shares of the fund that it did not own. Shortly after the tender offer was filed, we filed the instant action in the Court of Chancery. We litigated the case intensively from the beginning with motions to expedite the proceedings, motions for protective orders, motions to compel. There was the production of more than 100,000 documents. There were 5 depositions, and we made 2 separate preliminary injunction motions. Following that litigation, those litigation activities, we agreed with the defendants to a settlement that provided class members with extensive disclosures about the sale, operation, marketing of MAT5. It provided investors with information about the tender offer. It provided investors with four separate options pursuant to which, they could either tender their shares in MAT 5 or they can remain investors in MAT 5, and finally provided investors with approximately $40 million in excess consideration over what they would have received under the original tender offer. Notwithstanding these benefits, the objectors raised a number of issues below, which the Court of Chancery found to be without merit, and the objectors are pressing those same issues here, hoping for what they lack in merit they can make up through volume. But unfortunately for the objectors, unfortunately for the class, they can't do that. The first issue that they raise is the due process issue. They claim that the opt-out right violated the class members' due process rights. It did not do so. We negotiated very hard to get an opt-out class in this case. Due to all the injunctive relief that we obtained, the class could have been certified as a non-opt-out class. However, we wanted to make sure that those who wanted to opt out were able to do so.
What are the permissible conditions for an opt-out?
The permissible conditions?
Yes.
Well, in this case, if someone has made a contractual arrangement to return something prior to revoking their tender, enforcing that pre-existing contractual arrangement is not a violation of due process. Here,
is it a burden?
It's a burden, but filling out a claim form or filling out an opt-out form is also a burden. There are a number of things that are a burden. However, the appellants have presented no evidence to support the notion that this is some sort of an impermissible or a high burden on behalf of investors. These people all understood, as the Chancery Court recognized, that if they were going to change their election, they were going to return the money. And importantly, what Citi was paying for, Citi agreed in the original tender offer to provide the April 30th NAV of the fund in exchange for the investor's shares and a release. And here, what the appellants want to do is pull back their release but keep the money. As part of them being paid early, they expressly agreed that if they were going to change their minds, they were going to give back the money. And it's not a due process violation to enforce their agreement that they entered into. As Justice Jacobs mentioned earlier, the case that they rely on, the Interop case, is completely distinguishable here because effectively in that case, the investors who opted out would have been left without a remedy in their case because there would be no money left to pay them if they opted out of the class and didn't take whatever pro rata portion of the class settlement they have. Here there's no argument made, despite Citigroup's problems, that they would be unable to pay for any judgments obtained by those who opted out. And the opt-out right...
How do you respond to the other side's argument, as I understand it anyway, that enforcing the contract, this isn't enforcing the contract because the contract didn't contemplate this subsequent class action?
The contract did contemplate any reason whatsoever that either Citigroup would revoke the tender offer or that the investors chose to revoke their tender. There'd be a number of reasons that may not have been thought about at that time that they executed the tender offer or that they decided to get paid early. That was an election that the investors made, but once they made that election, they then had an obligation to make sure they could pay the money back if they wanted to change their minds. And no one has come in.
Well, your point is that revocation is a two-way street.
That's correct.
All right. Was that understood and contemplated at the time of the original tender offer, the early settlement arrangement?
Yes, it was contractually agreed upon that if either side were going to revoke the tender offer or revoke their tender or revoke the offer, they were going to pay the money back.
Okay, so your point then, if I understand it correctly, is that this particular opt-out option was simply an instance of a revocation, this time, however, by the shareholders.
That's correct. And there's nothing in the Constitution that prevents parties from contracting certain rights or remedies that they may otherwise not have or may have.
Well, can at least theoretically, couldn't those issues be dealt with separately, apart from the opt-out provision?
They could be dealt in with an ancillary litigation. However, part of the settlement was to make sure that the class members who chose not to opt out wouldn't bring ancillary litigation. It would have made no sense to city to, at least that's what they told us during the negotiations, to have a bunch of ancillary litigation about the opt-out if the goal of the settlement and the reason why they were providing an extra $40 million was to make sure that the litigation would be over with respect to those who opted out, with respect to those who didn't opt out. Now, notably, 15% of the class did opt out. And according to the vice chancellor's opinion, that those claims could be worth upwards of $100 million. And the federal securities plaintiffs can pursue those claims as a class action in federal court, and they're free to do so in their own case. And we haven't interfered with that right in any way. It's just the people who wanted to take part in this settlement were able to do so. And that's something that the federal district court recognized as well when the appellants went to that court and asked that that they have discovery into the tender offer because they felt that it was impermissibly releasing their claims that they had asserted in the federal district court. And what the Judge Buchwald from the Southern District of New York said is, I won't give you discovery into that. These people are all accredited investors. They're high net worth people. They should be able to decide for themselves whether accepting a portion of the money now is more advantageous to them than waiting for a case that has not been, where the sufficiency of the allegations haven't been tested and where the class has not yet been certified. So she did not believe that the tender offer would infringe on the plaintiff's rights in the federal case.
Well, the opt-out issue ties into a second issue that's been raised here, and that is the claim that the settlement was unreasonable because proponents did not satisfy their burden of proving that the release of the claims that were pending in the non-Delaware actions was fair. That is, was being fairly compensated. Now, with respect to the opt-outs, there's no argument because the opt-outs, are being allowed to pursue those claims. But those who accepted the other options, any of the other options, would have to release those claims. What is your response to the argument that the record that was made before the vice chancellor wasn't sufficient to establish the fairness of that release?
Well, the short answer is the argument's without merit. And the reason why is because we took discovery into the sale, operation, and marketing of the fund. And let me just back up and explain the claims that are pending in the Southern District of New York. They're brought primarily under Section 12A2 of the Securities Act of 1933, and that deals with the sale of the an offering of the fund. We took discovery into the sale, operation, and marketing of the fund. We also received documents that were provided to the SEC in connection with its investigation into the sale and marketing of the fund. We reviewed all of that. We reviewed the strengths and weaknesses of the claims. And as Vice Chancellor Lamb noted in his opinion, in order to bring a case under Section 12A2 of the Securities Act, you need to have a public offering made pursuant to a prospectus. Here, the fund was sold as a private placement, and there was no prospectus. So those claims suffer from some inherent weakness.
In other words, 12.2 may not apply?
That's correct. And that's what the Vice Chancellor has recognized, and the defendants have moved to dismiss that case on those grounds. So we considered all of this, and we considered the maximum amount that you can recover in that case under a rescission theory was $800 million. And here we got approximately $45 million in cash consideration over and above what was offered under the original tender offer. And considering the strength or weaknesses of those claims, we felt that the settlement was fair and reasonable.
Well, I understand what you're telling us, and presumably you told the same thing to the vice chancellor who understood it. The question, though, is what record was made to support, you know, what you communicated orally?
Well, there was an affidavit submitted by me to the vice chancellor where we went over the history of the litigation and what we did and the type of discovery that we took in the litigation. There was briefing on the issue of the strength and the or weaknesses of the underlying 12-2 claims that were asserted in the district court in the Southern District of New York. And
well, that may be, but were those briefs made part of the settlement record here?
I believe the briefs are in the record. And the vice chancellor considered that, and the vice chancellor conducted his analysis of the 12-2 claims in the opinion and order where he mentions the issue about the prospectus and the public offering. So the vice chancellor was aware, and it's actually in the opinion and order, his analysis of the strengths or weaknesses of those claims. And applying his own business judgment, he felt that the settlement provided fair and reasonable relief. Now, as this court has held on numerous occasions in Nottingham Partners, for example, in Barkham versus Amstead, this court doesn't superimpose or substitute its business judgment for that of the Chancery Court. And the Chancery Court conducted an orderly process to deduce that the settlement was fair and reasonable. It was supported by the record, and therefore the decision of the Chancery Court shouldn't be disturbed and should rather be affirmed. The appellants didn't go into certain issues that I'll just touch upon briefly. For example, they claim that the notice here needed to comply with the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act. The plain language of that statute indicates it only applies in cases brought under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, asserting claims under the Federal Securities Acts. This case did neither of those, and I would direct the court to the case of Land versus Ludroff from the Western District of Pennsylvania in 2008, where the federal court, even though a case was releasing federal securities claims, held that the notice did not need to comply with the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act. And the final issue that they raise on appeal concern their exclusions and intervention from the class, certain class members who had asserted claims and were actively prosecuting those claims were excluded from the definition of the class. We did so that they would not be burdened with having to opt out, although they could opt into the class. And certain of them did indeed do so. And as far as the motion for intervention goes, there was no prejudice to the denial of that motion because obviously all of the objectors' issues are being considered, notwithstanding the denial of the intervention. They did not have a right to intervene because they were not class members and therefore had no interest in the litigation, and there was no need for permissive intervention. As the vice chancellor noted, it would have unduly delayed this action and the settlement for the class members who wanted to take it. Unless the court has any further questions from me, I'll yield the rest of my time to Mr. Lesner.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
May it please the court, just to follow up on Justice Jacobs' question. In the record, the vice chancellor did consider the potential strengths and weaknesses of the claims released in the settlement, and in particular, in his opinion at page 23, he discussed the fact that there were substantial obstacles to full recovery and discussed that there had been no class certified in New York, that the complaint hadn't been tested, that there was a motion to dismiss, that there was a doubt that Section 12A would cover these types of claims, and that there were major class certification issues involved in that some of the claims, as far as the sales practices, would have been individual. The record in this case is at B-270 starts the argument on the motion to dismiss, which was submitted in the New York action, which contains a full discussion of the 12A2 record. So it's clear that the vice chancellor considered the strengths and weaknesses, particularly the weaknesses of the New York claim in evaluating the settlement. And in particular, those who wished to still pursue it, of course, had their opt-out right. There's one other point that was addressed, that somehow the settlement was rushed through. And again, that is not supported by the record. In their briefs, the appellants cite to the fact that they didn't have time to evaluate the discovery record in the case and that, that the hearing maybe should have been put off. However, the record is clear that the appellants asked for, submitted discovery on the Wednesday before Thanksgiving. I asked for it on December 3rd. 100,000 pages was given to them at the time they requested. Additional documents of correspondence between the defendants and the plaintiff's counsel was given to them. They had plenty of time to evaluate it. It is not clear from the record whether they ever evaluated the documents that, that were given to them. Certainly, there's no record that they came before Vice Chancellor Lamb and said, we've just found a document that gives us rise to an inquiry that there might be something here and we should delay it.
Did they ask for more time?
They did ask for more time, but it was not granted.
And the reason given was what?
The reason granted there was plenty of time for the class to have evaluated the settlement, and also that these particular objectors had had plenty of time. The MOU had been filed October 17th. The notice of the settlement had been filed November 10th, and it wasn't until November 26th that they asked for the documents. They asked for them by December 3rd, and they were given the documents by December 3rd. So they had plenty of time before the settlement to raise whatever issues they would have raised, that they could have raised. I see my time is up, Your Honors.
Thank you.
May it please the Court. I just want to address a couple of issues that were brought up by the appellees. With respect to the questions that Justice Jacobs posed earlier about a test that could be used to determine when a burden placed on an opt-out right violates the right to be excluded, that constitutional due process right, I think the real question is whether or not the opt-out right given allows the class member to maintain the status quo. And certainly in this case, what the parties seemed to argue for below was a maintenance of the status quo before the original tender offer. And that's really not what we are arguing for here. What we are arguing for is maintenance of the status quo before the settlement was approved and the class certified, and not really revocation of the original tender offer. Those are really two different concepts.
So that's a quibble over what the status quo is.
That is, in a sense, but I think it's important because really that right is given to allow the class members, these absent plaintiffs, to exclude themselves from the class action proceeding. Another point I'd like to address is the Land case that counsel brought up with respect to the issue of the PSLRA notice requirements. And I think that case is really distinguishable because it did not address the notice provision, but concerned an argument by an objector that the attorney fee limitations contained in the PSLRA should have been applied to state court proceedings. And importantly, in that case, the objector, who, like in this situation, was asserting federal securities claims in a federal district court, was actually a party to the discovery taken in that action and did not opt out of that settlement. And the court in that case even indicated that it would not have allowed the release of the federal securities claims if not for the fact that she did not object to the settlement of that related action. The last point I'll address is the arguments made by Mr. Lesner about the 12-2 claim. And I'd just like to point out that those claims have not been litigated and really not been tested in the federal district court. But the arguments that were made in that case by the defendants on their motion to dismiss don't take into consideration the fact that the Southern District has found that it's really a question of fact as to whether the offer is public or not. And
thank you. Your time is
thank
up.
Thank you, Your Honors.
The court appreciates the arguments and will take this matter under consideration and take a recess.
Right.